Hello and welcome to another episode of The Brave Front, your fortnightly dose of motivation and adventure, courtesy of our inspirational guests. My name's Tim Bainan, and before we go any further, please follow us on your usual podcast platform. And if you like what you hear, which I hope you do, especially given this episode's extraordinary guest, then leave us a review, all of which helps other people to find the show. And we want to hear from you too, so check out our episode question and poll and send us a voice message or get in touch to come on the show yourself. All the links you need are in the show notes. Now though, let's crack on with the episode. Here's what's coming up in the next hour as we discover the extraordinary story of mental strength behind the Jamaican bobsleigh team from the 1988 Winter Olympics. Yes, that's right, the very same four-man bobsleigh team that inspired the classic movie Cool Runnings.
Cannot find a comparable moment in sport, and you know, I will say that in hubris or boasting, I just state that as a fact for me. And I wake up, if somebody knows one, they can bring it to my attention. But I think it's one of the most remarkable sporting achievements in the history of mankind. And at the end of the curve, I was going up instead of coming down, so we went off. Went over, and my first thought was, you know, oh no, not in the Olympic Games. And then I hit my head very hard, so that quickly went away. So literally saw stars. But whenever I hit a high for, you know, sort of a optimum performance, a high level, then there would come a decline after that, guaranteed. And sort of the more intense the high, it would be the greater the cliff that you fall off. And I struggled with that for many years. You know, the story that I prefer to tell is how we went from being comedians in 88, literally 5 months training, didn't know what we were doing, ended up on our heads, lucky to be alive. To 6 years later, you know, being 10th on two of the four runs in the race, 14th overall, top seed finish, seventh nation, ahead of all the American sleds and so on. That's the journey that I would prefer to believe was legendary.
That was the unmistakably Jamaican tones of Dudley Tao Stokes, a true trailblazer and Olympic legend who literally drove the Jamaican bobsleigh team from complete obscurity in 1988 to a USA-beating, highly respected, seeded team in the 1994 Winter Olympics. An Olympic underdog, his is a story that has captured the imagination of millions, from those watching the Calgary Games live in 1988, to those who sat in cinemas across the world and who continue to stream at home today, as his story and that of his compatriots is forever retold in Cool Runnings, the John Candy mega movie from 1993. But as well as being an inspirational story of Jamaican sporting success, Tao's story is also one about overcoming personal adversity. Having suffered from depression for much of his life and having struggled to come to terms with the ultimate failure of the team following the horrific crash that brought their 1988 games to a premature end, Tao had to dig deep and call upon his military training to lead his country on to three further Olympic Games. Today, he inspires others, passing on the lessons he has learned and the techniques he used to hone his mental strength while competing. A mental health champion and advocate, Tao hopes that the achievements of the Jamaican bobsleigh team can help others across the world to overcome obstacles in their lives and to achieve their dreams. On a personal level, for me, I've always found myself drawn to underdog stories of sporting success, especially at the Olympics. In Britain, of course, we have Eddie the Eagle Edwards, who became our first ever Olympic ski jumper, spectacularly finishing in last place but capturing the heart of the nation, also in 1988. And who can forget Eric the Eel Musambani from Equatorial Guinea, who had never even seen an Olympic-sized swimming pool before diving into one for the 100-metre freestyle heats in Sydney in 2000, clocking a record slow time. It is not that they failed, it's because they tried. That is what makes underdog stories so powerful. It is about defying the odds to take part and then giving it your very best shot when you do. What makes the Jamaican bobsleigh team different, of course, is that they, with Dudley Tao Stokes in the driving seat, were not one-time wonders. They came back again, and again, and again. Dudley, Tal Stokes. Thank you for joining us here on the Brave Front. How are you doing? How are you?
Very good, thank you. Very good.
And where do we find you today, Tal? Where are you?
I am in my home in the Turks and Caicos island called Providenciales, which is not as exotic as you think. I actually was born in the Turks and Caicos, spent my early life here before moving back to Jamaica. Parents are Jamaicans, and
I'm talking to you from Jamaica
for my formative years.
Nice. Well, listen, I'm talking to you from a very wet and grey and miserable Hampshire in England. I'm assuming it's better there.
Yeah, believe you me, it is.
Good to hear. Listen, now, it's not very often I get to talk to somebody who has inspired one of my favourite films of all time, and also someone who has achieved so much and great fame for you know, what you have achieved over your lifetime and a couple of events in particular. Can I ask you, does a day go by for you without someone either mentioning Cool Runnings or the Winter Olympics in 88?
There's been the odd one, but that would be an unusual day. Usually, you know, I can count in a year one hand.
Yeah.
So it's difficult to escape from, you know, impossible.
Okay, well, that's a good thing, I think. That's a good thing to be remembered for that. How does it make you feel today? Because I've read a lot about you. I did some research before we met, before we did this interview. And everywhere refers to you as legend, the legendary team from 88. How does legend status sit with you?
You know, I'd rather be a legend for some different reasons. it's greatly tied to Cool Runnings, which was not a documentary about me or the team. And, you know, the story that I prefer to tell is how we went from being comedians in 88, literally 5 months training, didn't know what we were doing, ended up on our heads, lucky to be alive and walking. To 6 years later, you know, being 10th on two of the four runs in the race, 14th overall, top seed finish, 7th nation, ahead of all the American sleds and so on. So that's the journey that I would prefer to believe was legendary. But no, legendary refers to 88 and Cool Runnings.
Listen, I mean, you just, you know, that's a legacy and a half to leave behind, not only for the memories that you've created, but for establishing Jamaica on the Winter Olympic scene and the winter sports scene, and for going from that one place, from that place of disappointment, I know, that you felt at the time, through to achieving so much and beating the Americans, as you say. That's a great achievement over a short space of time, really.
Yeah, I think I cannot find a comparable moment in sport. And, you know, I will say that in hubris or boasting, I just state that as a fact from here. I wake up, if somebody knows one, they can bring it to my attention. But I think it's one of the most remarkable sporting achievements in the history of mankind.
You're absolutely right. And tell me, how are you and the team and all those people that you've bobsled with over the years, how are you remembered back in Jamaica?
Funnily, for the most part, I mean, you know, the original teams are held in high regard for what we did, which of course is well known in Jamaica, especially for the generation who lived through it. So it's home. It's always a pleasure to go there, and we're received very well.
Apart from talking to me on podcasts like this, and people like me on podcasts like this, what does day-to-day life have in store for you today? What does life involve?
It's really a lot about putting together content for you know, my program, which is ready every day. So I work with people on how they can get up and go every day without bad long-term consequences to their health. Athletes, business people, entrepreneurs, students, all sorts of people. And simple, inexpensive, effective, sustainable solutions to good health and so peak performance. And that's what I do on a day-to-day basis. It involves a lot of reading, listening, checking where the science has reached against my experience and what I know to have worked over the last 30 years, and trying to put that out, trying to use social media regularly, which doesn't come naturally, but it's key. And then I do speak, so I travel a couple of times a month, the UK, USA, and talk to people. And I, you know, try to slip in my message on the back of cool runnings and a bobsleigh story, which is what everybody wants to hear. And and I try to become better at that. So that's basically what I do every day. I am quite physical. So, you know, at 6 o'clock this morning, I was in my daughter's workout class. She's very fit, and she put a bunch of us through a grueling routine. And I rushed back to be ready for this.
Excellent. Yeah. So it sounds like a great way to start the day. And it sounds like you're a super busy man as well, jetting off all over the world and keeping yourself super busy. Listen, I must ask you, obviously, it sounds like your day-to-day work, you know, and the program you're doing in terms of inspiring others to sort of build resilience and be mentally strong. Has mental health and mental resilience and mental well-being been something that you've been aware of and been a big part of your life over the years?
Yes, it has. You know, in my early years, I suffered from severe bouts of depression, which we thought was just a family trait. But after any performance, I mean, good or bad, then there was a massive down that I thought I just had to live through. You can imagine my feeling after the crash in 88 and so on. Mm-hmm. But eventually over time, I came to understand the reasons for it. And, you know, basically by working to balance the physical things. So they balance your vitamin, mineral intake, the state of your body, and optimize your neurotransmitters, hormones, and so on. Then I got much better. And also, you know, sort of a cognitive recognition that depression is a mechanism that we have as human beings, that has a meaning. In the same way we feel happy, there are times when we have to feel depressed. It's two sides of the same coin. And that's not the problem. The problem comes when any condition becomes chronic.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting talking to people who are, especially professional sports people, who talk about depression it being linked inevitably sometimes to performance. And you said there that it's something that you suffered even in the good times as well as the bad.
Whenever I hit a high for, you know, sort of a optimum performance, a high level, then there would come a decline after that, guaranteed. And sort of the more intense the high, it would be the greater the cliff that you fall off. And I struggled with that for many years, till my mid-20s, I would say late 20s.
Well, listen, I want to dig a bit more into that, and especially the you know, what happened to you mentally after 88 and after the crash in a bit. We'll come on to that. But if you don't mind rewinding the clock a bit, and we'll go back to life before bobsleighing. Tell me a little bit about that. Again, I've done a little bit of research, and as I understand it, you were, after school, you joined the army, moved to Canada and learned to fly helicopters. Is that right?
Yeah. So I joined the army first as an infantry officer. So I actually went to the United Kingdom, spent almost 2 years at Sandhurst, okay, Royal Military Academy, and then I back to Jamaica. I was in the army for about a year, and then switched to the air wing, or the air corps, as they call it there. And went to Canada, learned to fly, and came back and flew for about 8 years. So, you know, very, lots of travel, lots of exposure, lots of hanging around, fear the dangerous things, and learning that, you know, risk has to be managed, and the things that you have to do. So it was a great education. Would not have swapped it. I wouldn't swap it for anything else.
Yeah, absolutely. Alice, I imagine being in the UK and then in Canada gave you exposure to the cold as well, I imagine.
Yeah. So that's you know, one of the secrets of cool running, is that when I came into bobsleigh, that was not my experience with cold. That been on Salisbury Plains in trenches, you know, the temperature dropped, Northern Europe, but in particular, Canada, Prairie Provinces. I was in Manitoba near Winnipeg, and on the same spot, I stood on the same spot where it was negative 100 degrees Fahrenheit with a wind chill, and then it was plus 100 in a matter of months, the same spot, plus 100, yeah. Brutal weather through the center of Canada.
Yeah. Oh God. That's. Yeah. I can't moan here in England when you talk about a temperature change like that. And it was in Canada, wasn't it, that you met the American guys who first came up with the concept for the bobsleigh team? Was that right?
No. You know, I was actually back in Jamaica. I was working in the air wing, flying helicopters. I was a member of the Army football team. And the guys who came up with the idea, the Americans, were actually resident in Jamaica. One was married to a Jamaican, and the other one was working with the U.S. Embassy. And they knew the colonel in charge of sport in the Army. So they were having trouble, as you can imagine. They've been at this for a few years. They were having trouble getting athletes. So they went to this colonel and said, "We need some guys from the Army," you know, basically tell them to go. And to try this bobsleigh. And the colonel said, great sport, great for soldiers. So he said, "What do you need?" They said, "Speed, power." He said, all right, I'll give you this guy, that guy. And then they said at the end, "So we need somebody who is fairly athletic, but with proven hand-eye coordination to try to teach, to drive this thing in the next few months." And the rest, as they say, is history.
Yeah.
But the colonel said, I have the man for you. So that colonel was Ken Barnes, who was John Barnes' father.
Yes, I heard that story.
Yeah,
yes.
Right.
Amazing. And when you first got word then, what, you know, that this was something that was being asked of you, and someone had singled you out as a likely candidate for that role, what went through your mind? You know,
I wasn't asked.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right. So I was told that there were these trials, they're looking to select people for the sport, bobsleigh. I was told by my commanding officer, and you need to be at these trials on Tuesday morning at 8 o'clock, National Stadium, something like that. But I was just told to go. I had to find out what bobsled was, which took some doing. This is pre-internet era and so on. So yeah, lots of phone calls and asking people, and then I was intrigued when I found out that this thing actually had to be driven. There was a skill involved in that. And that's what took me. I said, I'd like to see. Can I drive this? And but the guys who ended up on the team were basically people from the Army who were told to go.
Yeah. Did it appeal to you? It sounded like obviously someone who's flown helicopters and being a part of the Army, was there an adrenaline side of you, adrenaline junkie side of you that thought, actually, no, I really quite fancy this?
Yes, I do enjoy sort of trying extreme things and hard things, but there's not a massive adrenaline hit in going about it. You know, I wouldn't say I'm a daredevil, and I would just chuck off something to see, you know, what would happen at the bottom. But I do like an element of danger, and then how you manage that, and can you execute successfully, and that whole process. Now that really, really intrigues me.
Tell me a little bit then about how you went from those very early days and that proposition where you were said, this is what you've got to do, and here you go. How did things progress, and how did the team progress? And how do you deal with, I'm presuming as well that along the way, along that journey, there were plenty of naysayers and people who perhaps doubted why you were doing it, or why this was, what was going to happen. So how do you deal with them at the same time?
Yeah, no, lots. Yeah, as you can imagine, a lot of obstacles. It was, again, a sort of another school for me, because these two guys, you know, William Maloney and George Fitcher, two Americans, were entrepreneurs at heart, and they knew how to bring things together. And that's not something I'd experienced in life. So, you know, they conceptualized something from scratch, mobilized money, and made it happen. That was beautiful, but really very difficult. And, you know, in the initial phases, most of the obstacles were overcome by these guys. Where we got into trouble is when we started traveling to bobsleigh. Because once we started that, money was tight. You can imagine we're learning a new sport, trying to gel together as a team. There was one point where we had to go to Europe to finish a race to qualify, and where we actually had to sell t-shirts and sweatshirts to raise money for dinner that night. And so those things were, you know, challenges, and not everybody got through them. You know, not everybody could deal with it. So we lost one or two people along the way, but we were left with a good core of determined, committed athletes by this point.
Why did those people fall by the wayside? Was it because it was too challenging for them in that respect?
Yeah, it's difficult. Not everybody can get up every morning not knowing what they're going to eat for dinner, and you know, how things are going to go, and it's cold and it's wet, and you're going uphill, downhill, lot of work. Is you know, the combination of the sport, which is very demanding even before you get in the track, and of the support systems around us, non-existent, and also not knowing. So we didn't know really until the last day of December 1987 that we would actually be able to go to the Olympic Games in Calgary. Nothing like us had ever happened before. The International Federation and the Olympic Committee had no plan, they had no pathway, no guidelines, no regulations. Everybody just made things up as you went along, you know? Okay. So you're here this one day, and then the next day changes, and so it goes on, and that went on right to the very end of the Olympics. We did not go there having we didn't qualify a four-man team. We didn't enter a four-man team when we arrived. But we had two-man teams, and in the training, pre-Olympic training, the driver for the second team left. So we were down to one team. I was driving one person, but we had another two athletes. And, you know, they suggested that if we had a four-man, then everybody who has been on this journey, because by this time, you know, we've been through some tough times together, sleeping on airport floors and all that kind of stuff. So I said, you know, yeah, I'd drive the four-man. I'd see how good, you know, whether or not I can do it, but you need to convince George Fitch that this is something. So they convinced him. Now we tested it in training. I was said five, but when we got to the Olympics, we had no sled and we were not entered. And George Fitch managed to solve those problems. He rented an old sled off the Canadians, and he got the Olympic Committee to let us into the four-man in the Olympics. You know, I don't know. He was a real operator.
Yeah.
And yeah, so that's you know,
it's amazing. It's such an amazing story, and
yeah,
it's such an inspiring one. What was it that was going back to those hard times when you didn't know when the next meal was coming, and you didn't know even, you know, what the next step was going to be, and what was going to come that day? What was driving you? What was the goal that you were in your mind that you were aiming towards? Was it simply to be at the Olympics, or was it more than that?
We knew the big goal was to go through that opening ceremony and be on the start in the Olympic Games. That was the big goal. And then, of course, you had to split that down in smaller steps. And then steps got added in, as we said, because there was no pathway. So steps then get added in. And then, you know, you have a new target. But as in life, and part of what I teach is that you look out and you set a bigger target, right? And I mean, that target must have a purpose. And I had a lot going on from childhood. Always wanted to represent Jamaica in a sport. I thought I'd lost that opportunity. You know, the big one was football, and I just wasn't quite there. nor in a position really to put in the effort that may have been necessary. So I thought I'd lost the opportunity. So this came up, opportunity to put on the Jamaican colors, represent the country. Yeah. So
are you a true patriot then? Jamaica is runs through every vein in your body.
Yeah, I don't think that there is a Jamaican of which that is not true. It's a small country, small, relative number of people, a huge cultural bond across all class, color, creeds, whatever, and anywhere that you get to in the world, somebody opens their mouth, you know, that's a Jamaican. I immediately meant that connection. It doesn't matter where you are. You could be in the Balkans or in South America somewhere. It happens, bound to happen. So there's that strong bond. And then, you know, there's some pride at the way we punch above our weight, which especially in the arts, music, literature, which is probably less well known, and sculpture. There's a competition recently for the Windrush generation, and I started to commemorate them. That was won by a Jamaican artist. So Jamaicans travel, move, migrate, integrate, assimilate, and stay the same. So it's a fascinating hold that culture has on Jamaicans. And, you know, especially in track and field, the pinnacle of being a Jamaican is to pull on the black, green, and gold.
Yeah.
And get up in front of the world to make a statement.
I can see that whenever you see a Jamaican on the national stage, on the international stage, you know, you see the pride. It just oozes across, it comes across. And with that in mind, I must ask you, how did you feel, or how did you all deal with the level of expectation then? Because even before you got to the start line of that first run, the whole world was watching you, not only Jamaica, but the whole world was watching you, and you know, everyone was talking about you and the team. How were you aware of that? Did you try and shut it out? How did you deal with that?
That was a tremendous amount of pressure. Needless to say, it was the most pressure that I'd met in my life to that date. But I was not unprepared for it. So remember, helicopter pilot, had gone through that training, having gone through infantry training, having commanded men and machines at great cost, had gone through some tough times, lost friends, some of them in front of my eyes, and so on. So you had to develop mechanisms. You become a bit hardened by that. And then, but coming into the Olympic Games, you know, I knew I needed to become better mentally, preparing mentally for competition. And I walked into a bookstore in Calgary, in Canada, and, you know, to sort of find a book on mental conditioning and so on. And the first book in front of my eyes was a book called Peak Performance by a guy called Charles Garfield. And I have a copy right here behind me. One or two books that never leave my sight. And he had a methodology that was originally Russian. Other people don't understand the history of the Russians in the mental approach to sport. It's very deep. I mean, it's going back to Pavlov and all of these guys. So they've been at it for a long time. And they've developed, they knew a lot well ahead of what we now know today. And so he had a chance to observe that close up, and he set it out in his book. And I studied that book. So, you know, I had, even by the time I got to Calgary, I had a framework and a system, and I was able to get myself in a state of mind to perform.
I read somewhere that involved visualization for you in terms of mentally visualizing the run and mentally visualizing what you were about to do.
Yeah, right? Yeah. heavy visualization. That's been the key for me to everything I've done in bobsleigh, because I have over 10 years, four Olympic Games sounds like a lot. I have about 600 descents, which is what a top-class driver gets maybe in two seasons. And most people that you see at the top level are certainly over a decade, but many are over 15 years in the sport. So just to put it, but I made up for that by having high quality visualized runs, which is a talent on my part. I've always been good at imagining things and creating whole worlds in my head. And I spent many hours as a child just doing that, bouncing a tennis ball in the garage and dreaming up whole worlds and off worlds and universes and so on. And it wasn't a waste of time, because when I learned of this technique, you know, if I close my eyes, then it would spring into my head as if it was there. And so I worked on that over the years and became very good. That's the thing, and maybe the one thing that I know I'm at a world-class level at. It's what I call mental relaxation and rehearsal. And I like to use rehearsal as opposed to visualization, because, you know, it is a systematic practice, almost like the army, a dress rehearsal of what is going to happen. And it's done exactly down to the timing. And if you can get to that level, I think it's very difficult for most people. But it's a real super weapon. So when you combine that with being able to get into the peak performance state of mind, regardless of your external environment, and then having done this mental rehearsal and execute, I'll tell you a story from 88, which didn't end well, but it's a real story. So I crashed on the third run, which was the first run of the second day. And we were early, like third sled off, fourth somewhere. Anyway, I woke up and I had caught the Olympic bug fever. So I had a temperature well over 100 degrees and so on. So I took some aspirin. You know, you have to be careful when you're competing. You can't just take anything. So
no.
Anyway, I took some aspirin, went out to the track, walking in the track before the race, which is part of the routine and so on, got the curve four, slipped, fell, broke my collarbone.
Oh my God.
On the right side. So I get to the top. We don't have a physio, of course, but the British physios are Jamaican. In fact, I think they something like 8 of 12 people on the Great Britain bobsleigh team were Jamaicans. Phenomenal staff and so on. Anyway, so the physio, basically, he numbed the area. And then I went to the start block, then warm up, went out to the start block and so on, and getting myself going, and then finally going in my cocoon, ready to go. And George Fitch, who was standing there, said to me, oh, you know, the coach, who had always been at the start for every start I'd done, he said, well, the coach left, he had to go back to work. So he flew out this morning, called me from the airport. So that shattered me. Mm. So I stood there on the block. I had to go right back through a whole program. And I was actually stabilized when we started. Well, of course, fresh ice, 7th fastest start for the whole race. We jump in the sled, and it was just a different world. There's nothing I'd visualized before, because of the speed and the corners. So I just got continually behind until we crashed. But coming out of that, to access and maintain the peak performance state, regardless of your external circumstances, that is what separates goodness from greatness.
Yeah, well, gosh, I mean, there's a lot to unpick there. That's amazing. Thank you. The mental rehearsal is fascinating. I've heard sports scientists talk before about how Formula One drivers do something similar to get themselves in that mental space. So obviously, it's a really powerful tool, and that it's something that professional sports people must lean on quite a lot.
Or they should. But you know, I have to say, in the sport of bobsleigh, I mean, when I arrived, that was rock solid. If you know bobsled startups and you see all the drivers, you know, with their eyes closed, visualizing driving, some of them are quite dramatic. I've seen guys get smacked a driver going into a particular curve. So, I mean, I knew that this was a thing. But everybody has their own way of doing it. And, you know, it comes more naturally to some people than to others. But to have a system that's tried and true over the years and you know, bed it in, that is something that should be in every sports person. Actually, everybody in life should be doing. Again, what I teach is this simple, of course, inexpensive, highly effective, but also sustainable. You can do it every day. You can bring it to everything in your life.
Sure.
So, you know, I ran through a quick 3-minute visualization of this interview, which looked nothing like what we're doing now.
Yeah. still very difficult to visualize something sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah.
So listen, tell me a little bit about how 1988 went. Tell me about the crash and what your recollections of that are. I had a look at it on YouTube before we talked, and it reminded me, I hadn't seen the footage for a very long time, but I instantly remembered it when I saw it. How do you look back on that?
Well, it's one of the defining events of my life. I don't think it's an exaggeration to say it could easily have ended my life, but it didn't. But if, you know, I take you back. We went through how I arrived at the start block. I wasn't in the best shape. And then, you know, we had this fantastic start, smooth load. We were going very fast. And I was just behind the sled. Not like the movie, no bolts broke or so on. They were being kind to me. Completely my fault. Started what they call porpoising in the 270 degree Kreisel turn, which just means that the pressure points in the curve where you need to be steering, I was missing them. So when you miss it and the pressure, which is really gravity, takes the sled, then it goes up. You know, so the centrifugal force, it goes up and then you steer, but you're too late. So suddenly you're out of gravity and you dive down. And then you stop steering or you're hitting and so you porpoise. And at the end of the curve, I was going up instead of coming down. So we went over. And my first thought was, you know, oh no, not in the Olympic Games. And then I hit my head very hard. So that quickly went away. So literally saw stars. So then I tried to do the drill for the driver and a crash is that you get under the cowling. So I was trying to get under the cowling, but the guys were packed really badly. We had the wrong type of helmets. You know, we had motocross helmets with a long snout. Couldn't get it around. So I hit my head twice more. And then I realized I wasn't going to get a lot of colon and that, you know, this is it. So I just relaxed. And you know, the thought came into my head, like, how did you end up here on your head in a bobsled track in Calgary? and it occurred to me that this is not how things were supposed to go. So literally, you know, the next 15, 18 seconds of the crash, I went through my mind all of the things that I learned hanging around George Fitch, William Maloney, and our own bobsleigh. And I put together a program in my head, which I then shared with my brother after we came to a stop, that of how we were going to become a world-class team. And so that's how I spent the last part of the crash, because I really didn't have anything better to do.
So even during the crash, you were thinking about what's coming next?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, I was. And it turns out I was the only one. I mean, everybody was convinced before we got there that this was a one-off thing. And, you know, when we crashed, they were sure it was a one-off thing. But I could not leave the story there. I mean, I could have. That crash, a movie was always on the cards. George Fitch in particular always wanted to do a movie. And he was talking to people well before we got to Calgary. But that crash made a movie inevitable.
Yeah. Yeah. I think so.
Yeah.
It's a spectacular crash. And watching it back, I'd forgotten how long it takes for you to come to a stop.
2,000 feet, 26 seconds. Yeah.
That was incredible.
Yeah.
Absolutely incredible. When you did come to a stop, you know, and you got out and you know, you were able to speak to the guys as well. You know, what was that moment like, and what came next for you after that?
Well, yeah, in the immediate aftermath, if you look back at the footage, if you have one that goes that far, but I'm actually the last guy walking up. So Devon Harris, who's very outgoing, was in front. He was on waving to all the crowd, and then Michael White was behind him. My brother and I were at the very back, just trudging up, talking about, I found out he was all right or so on. But then immediately we got sent off to different ambulances, because they had ambulances at the finish. And my brother and I ended up in one, and people were shocked. Doctors were coming in to look at me. I said, no way. They are alive. This man can't walk. Other kind of things. But that's where I shared with Chris what our thoughts were for the future, what, you know, is going to happen. You know, where I'd need him to be ready. And then I didn't see the other guys until maybe an hour later or so on. But you know, by that time, they were still high on adrenaline. And everybody was just kind of marveling that we actually walked away from that.
Yes.
Now, I tell people it's harder to watch that crash than to be in it. That is my personal experience, yes.
Yeah,
you're busy, but watching it, you're sure that somebody has been seriously hurt, if not killed, is what.
Especially when you see your head against that
final thing when the sled finally came to a stop.
Yeah,
I have that picture around and look back at it. Whenever I think that things are getting hard, my wife was at the games, and she was at the start and saw us go off, but there were televisions around her, so, and she just saw the time going and going. I said, boy, this is a bad run. And then one of the coaches came up and grabbed her and said, come with me, the crash. We have to go down and see, because, you know, he too thought that there was at least one fatality, if not more. So,
God, well.
It was.
Your poor wife, that can't have been easy for her.
No, that was traumatizing. But yeah, again, we'd been married for only 3 years, but we knew each other for a while. So, you know, she knew the kind of person I was. But the commentator on that, a guy named John Morgan, who called that for the ABC, you know, who had the Olympic coverage, he's from a large family of bobsledders from Lake Placid. Several of them slid for America. He went into commentary, and he was commentating in Trevino in Italy in a race where his brother literally lost his head.
Wow.
Crashed him around a corner, and he was decapitated while John Morgan was on the mic in front of the camera.
Oh,
so that crash for him was like a triggering experience.
I don't think I'd be able to ever watch a bobsleigh again if I actually
these are some really tough guys. Not in terms of being unfriendly or
mental
tragedies and mental strength. Yes, the things that they live with and keep coming back is something else.
Yeah. Listen, talking about mental strength, tell me a little bit about after Calgary and after the Olympics. I read, again, just reading a bit about you before I came on, I read that you really struggled with what happened. And was there a period of depression for you after that in terms of dealing with the failure of what had happened?
Yeah, well, I was depressed for a long time, I think it's fair to say. Which, probably only my wife knew. I thought that we'd be persona non grata in Jamaica, but it turns out there were a lot of happy people. So folk, came out to meet us through parties and so on. Well, I had to do that, going through it, not feeling 100%. I think fortunately, I still have a broken collarbone. So I got 2 weeks off from work. during which time I learned to type with my broken collarbone. But, and, you know, just to stay home and do stuff and so on. So I was able to get through it without having too much external pressure. Mm-hmm. But that was, you know, probably the most difficult period of my life, I think. A few other things have happened, but that one was difficult because it seemed to me that there was no end.
But you still had in your mind that plan to go back. It wasn't like you're thinking you thought that I'd failed and that was it. You still had that plan in your mind to keep going.
I did, and now I was discovering quite what would be involved in getting that plan off the ground, even in this 2 weeks. So, you know, the guys who founded it, William and George, this was their one-off thing. And they walked away, putting this thing to bed. Thank you very much. So first I had to convince them, which was probably the hardest part. And I blackmailed them a bit by saying that, you know, imagine you phoned me, you took me to Calgary, you almost killed me, and now you're gone. You need to raise some money. Let's do this again. And so they agreed to do another 4 years. And that kind of was the turning point. Once that happened, then we could start working concretely.
And how did you shift your mindset then from a place where you were struggling, with depression, and you wanted to, you know, presumably you still wanted to have that focus for 92 and pushing on to there. How did you lift yourself to a place where you could do that?
Yeah, well, there are a couple of things. One is time. It all takes time, right? There's really no shortcut way to it. But the second thing is purpose. And I had a purpose, which, as you say, was 92. And to this day, I divide my life into what we call quads, which is an Olympic cycle. So 4 years, where you're going to be in 4 years, break it down year by year and so on. So I started that. I had purpose was 92. And then with time, kind of the cloud lifted. And then I started moving. There are a lot of practical things of which I was not aware at the time. But, you know, I was lucky to be living in Jamaica at the time, as I'm fortunate to be here now because I get a lot of sunlight. And sunlight is key, and it's one of the real challenges in Great Britain, England. yes, as you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the lighting situation.
I don't think I've seen sunlight in about 6 weeks.
Yeah, and we need it. You know, we need it not for vitamin D production and so on, yes. But we also needed for many, many functions of the brain and resetting the circadian rhythm, which is crucial.
And presumably as well, that bore fruit in the subsequent Olympic Games. And tell me a little bit about how you felt as those went. So 92, 94, 98, what went through you or how did you sort of, I can see how you progressed with the team. How did that change, or how did you change mentally and did your mental strength grow at the same time as your success?
92 were the worst games of my career. So 88, 92, 94, and 98. 92 was the worst because, you know, we'd gotten to a fairly high level, actually, even by 92. And in our pre-Olympic training camp, we were very competitive with the American team that was also on that track in Austria training. And so I went to Abbeville with very high expectations of myself. I didn't come together. I got sick again well before the games. And so I went into training and so on. I was sick right through the two-man and into the four-man. And we did okay, but there was nothing spectacular. So we didn't perform or we didn't crash. And, you know, George and William said, fine, you know, all right, we did over 4 years. This all was great and so on. And they went away. So that was, I spent the whole games under a lot of pressure, stress, depressed during the games. And then after the games, it was bad. What saved me is that the Winter Olympics has been switched out of the same year as the Summer Games into what essentially is a World Cup year. So you know, you have the Summer Olympics, and then 2 years later you have the Winter. But to change it, what they do is to have two Winter Olympics in 2 years.
Yeah.
Being the smaller games, that was the one to move. So Abbeville, France, 92. Lillehammer, Norway, 94. So those 2 years means that there's one gap season. And, you know, we didn't have, sort of, I didn't have any money. In that season, I borrowed $5,000 from a friend and went to Lillehammer, the Olympic track, where a friend of ours was actually in charge of the bobsleigh track. And I stayed in his house, and he pulled strings and got me out on the track and sliding and so on. For 2 weeks, that was it. Went back home. But then that was 1993. And, you know, in the summer of that year, we had some really major changes. One is that I brought on a friend of mine, schoolmate, who was also in the army, had gone away and got an MBA and so on and knew all that management stuff. So we asked him to come into the Federation to organize it. So he came in with all the management charts and graphs and all of that. And we organized a talent hunt. We found a couple of spectacular athletes. And then, but we still didn't have any money or anything to do. But then October 1, 1990, the release of Cool Runnings. And things exploded. We had the Jamaican premiere. The cast came down. And, you know, at a big premiere, all the big wigs were there. And so the head of Red Stripe Beer came to me after the premiere and say, you know, how much do you need to go to the next games? And I said, $60,000, which is what we had penciled out in the budget. And he said, all right, you know, you come by my office tomorrow for a check.
Wow.
I said, oh, no, right. I started revising.
Yeah.
So I should have asked for 100. But anyway, there you go. Yeah. $60,000. You know, the Americans with sled development and athletes and so on, their program was close to $6 million. And we ended up ahead of them at that race.
So is that the highlight for you in terms of
achievement? Lillehammer was, yeah.
Yeah.
Again, not apparent at the time. You know, I was hopeful to go on to do other things, but then it didn't all work out. I went away from my basics for the next 4 years. And even though we were a good team, we raced a lot, we did well in places, but we didn't channel our resources quite as well as I had when we didn't have any.
It's just worth stressing what you just said early on, though. So you had a budget of $60,000 courtesy of Red Stripe. And the check, which you should have asked for $100,000 for.
Yeah.
But you beat the Americans, who had a budget of $6 million.
Yeah.
That is the ultimate David versus Goliath story, isn't it? It really is.
Yeah, it is. But you know, the problem with resources is that when you have a lot of money, the solutions you seek just seem to be more expensive.
Yeah.
You know, it's very few people that can have a lot of money and really whittle things down to the essentials. Now you need the bells and whistles and that they are bells and whistles. But
yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Very expensive bells and whistles for the Americans. Listen, I've taken up a huge amount of your time and I won't take up too much longer, but I have to ask you, as you look back on your life and you look back on everything and you look back on your bobsleighing and everything, what gives you most, what's your happiest memory? What gives you, what's your, you know, what sticks with you? It's the first thing you think of when you look back.
You know what? The most pleasant and lasting experience is meeting a Jamaican somewhere in the world. And they say, oh, you're the bobsleigh guy. And they hug you up and people start crying and so on. And I saw that. And that's moving. The number of things I mean, we have, as a nation, you have lots of accomplishment, as you know. But that one is special to a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
I can't say I've met a Jamaican who doesn't know exactly what Jamaica bobsleigh was, exactly what cool running was, exactly how we went. In Jamaica itself, everybody knows the 94 story inside out. And, you know, Linda Della Penna was a great Jamaican footballer. He's from the 50s. He played football in Middlesbrough and Portsmouth and so on. And he was back in Jamaica on a sports commentator. And after he showed her the run. They showed the 94 team, the race. And afterwards, he came on television and he said, I put it to you that that is the greatest performance from a Jamaican team we have ever seen. I remember that.
That must make you proud.
Yeah.
Tao, listen, thank you so much for your time. I'm hugely grateful to you. Just one last question, actually. What word of advice would you give to anybody in any situation who may feel themselves as an underdog? What would your advice be to anybody, no matter what the situation in life, where you go into it thinking, you might go into it thinking, there's people who are much more experienced than I am, much better than I am, but I've got to go into it. What would your advice be to anybody in any underdog situation?
The advice I stick with, which I've used successfully, is ignorance and confidence. Now, the ignorance is a willful ignorance of all the things that can go wrong and how bad you are and so on. All right? And when I say a willful ignorance, there are things that you're going to need to know realistically. And you need to find out those things. You need to control your risk. You need to find your edge and build on it. Right? Your edge. When I was a footballer back in Jamaica, I failed to make a team at 15 because I was slow and a list of things which my mother got from the coach. But the thing that nobody did well on that team or most of the teams in Jamaica was to head the football. So I spent hours heading a football. And I made several teams just on that basis, right? Several teams first on the team sheet because this is the man that's going to get the ball in the air. So you need to find your edge and sharpen it. And the next thing is confidence. That, this is going to work out. This thing is going to come together. And you need confidence because if you're an underdog, you need to act. You need to do something. And if you are lacking in confidence, it's going to be hard to motivate yourself to move. So find your edge and move into it and forget everything else.
Brilliant advice. Tao, thank you very much. It's been a huge privilege and a great honour for me to talk to you. I'm very grateful for your time. And yeah, I'd love to keep in touch. So thank you very much. It's been an absolute honour.
And you. Bye now.
That's it for this episode. Huge thanks to Dudley Tao Stokes for taking us back to 1988 and inspiring us to think differently about what it takes to succeed. If you want to find out more about the Jamaican bobsleigh team, you'll find the YouTube videos of their runs on this episode's blog post. You can also find links to Dudley's social profiles in the show notes. And if you fancy watching Cool Runnings, it's currently streaming on Disney Plus in the UK. You'll also find our episode question in the show notes too. And this time, rather aptly, we want to know, have you ever been an underdog and how did you rise to the challenge? Our yes-no poll, meanwhile, asks, would you attempt the bobsleigh? You can answer both on the Spotify episode page, a link to which we found in the episode notes through the Linktree site in the show profile or the Brave Fund website, all the usual places. As ever, you can also interact with the show by sending us a voice message. So tell us what you think of our guests and the subjects we're discussing. You can also tell us your ideas for topics and things you'd like us to cover too. Again, just head to the show notes, the Linktree site or the Brave Fund website for more details and the links to do so. And finally, if you've enjoyed the show, please remember to leave us a review and follow us on whatever platform you usually get your podcasts. Every review and every follow helps other people to find the show. In the meantime, though, look after yourselves, and I'll see you soon. Take care.